It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Rob Ferret.
Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about a new study that says we should be eating even more fruits and veggies and get creative tips for incorporating those foods into our diet.
Tonight at 7 o'clock, the Wisconsin Conservation Congress is convening its annual forum. It's an opportunity for everyone in the state to share their thoughts on how the state is doing when it comes to managing wildlife and public lands in each of Wisconsin's 72 counties.
Wisconsin is the only state in the country that has these kind of state-sanctioned hearings for the public to talk about wildlife management. Here with us now to discuss how you can get involved and what will be on the docket this year is Wisconsin-based outdoor columnist Pat Durkin. Pat, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, last year's Conservation Congress meeting, it got pretty contentious. For instance, there was the wolf hunt issue at stake. What are the big issues up for discussion tonight?
It often depends on your perspective, but I know for muskie fishermen, the big question this year again is a question on whether we should allow motorized trolling statewide. And, you know, most of the counties already have allow you to troll for fishing, you know, with a motor, but there's some areas that don't. Another one that's real controversial with some folks is when it's an advisory question, which means it's just for advice only, but it asks whether we should allow tundra swan hunting. Right now, there's only 8 states in the country that allow tundra swans to be hunted, so that's a question that they'll be asking. Let's see. There's also a question I found kind of interesting, whether we should lift the ban on shooting albino deer. So lots of interesting questions that come up every year at these meetings. And, you know, it's again, it depends on what your perspective is as far as, you know, what's most controversial.
Can you give us some background on the Conservation Congress itself and what the purpose is behind it?
Yeah, the Congress itself, this is its 80th year. As an organization in Wisconsin, it basically came about back in the days of Aldo Leopold, where they wanted a more formal way to get people involved in our conservation issues in the state. And so it's been an organization since then, and every county in the state has 5 elected representatives. So one of the first things they do at these county meetings tonight is go through those 5 positions, and usually I think 2 or 3 every year that are up for election. And so people can nominate, you know, the incumbents or nominate new people and put it to a vote. And then these folks, they'll meet again, all of them who are elected, you know, the 5 from each county will meet in Wausau in about a month. And they go through all the questions that are asked tonight, and they basically, you know, vote again as counties and county representatives on the different questions. And in some cases, the ones that are kind of divided and not so clear-cut about, you know, where the majority lies, they'll debate those things at their statewide conference and then take those recommendations to the Natural Resources Board, which eventually sets policy for the DNR.
And would you consider it a fairly influential organizational body?
It can be. You know, it's like so many things in politics. Sometimes, you know, the questions that come up at these hearings tonight, certain lawmakers once in a while will say, hey, that's a good idea, and there's enough public sentiment, and they'll take it and run with it and basically make it their own idea and get it, you know, run it through as a law fairly quickly. Other times, you know, Congress recommendations get forwarded on and never seen again. So I think that's nothing that's really unusual in that regard as far as how we practice politics and government in our country. But it's, you know, It's always fun to kind of, I like the idea because it gives people this voice, and they might not always think they're being heard, but at least there's a form that's a formal form that we go through every year and do this. And like in your intro, you said this is the only state in the country that does that. So every time we find ourselves complaining about how sometimes mind-numbing these kind of meetings can be for people, you think, well, it is our process, it is our system, and it is something that, you know, we have an opportunity here that most people don't have.
And you mentioned one of the issues at stake tonight is people's opinions about the hunting of tundra swans. Mm-hmm. Now, this is one that a lot of people have expressed strong feelings about. Could you explain a little bit what opponents are saying about the prospect of swan hunting?
Yeah, the tundra swan issue, it's really interesting because, you know, there are states that allow They actually have hunting seasons in eight different states on tundra swans. None of them are in the Midwest, though. So if Wisconsin ever were to go forward with that, we'd be the first. You know, the other ones are out in the Dakotas and Montana, then out in the East Coast and New Jersey and Virginia and North Carolina. But the big controversy, for the most part, I think, boils down to the idea that tundra swans look an awful lot like trumpeter swans, and trumpeter swans are endangered. And trumpeter swans are bigger by about another third, beyond, you know, bigger than kind of losing my train of thought here.
Than the tundra swans.
Thank you. And so even I think the people who want to hunt tundra swans concede that these are very similar looking birds, and there is that risk factor involved. And, you know, so it is kind of hard to get around that, as far as if they're sharing the same flyway at a certain time of year. And it's, you know, then they make these arguments about, well, the one favors, you know, bigger water bodies of water than the other one. But I can think of times I've seen both of them on the same size of water, so I'm not sure we can ever get a real definite answer unless you know for certain. But the only way you really know for certain on these two is that the sound that the calls they make. And the trumpeter swan, you know, the name trumpeter, it sounds like a French horn, basically. If you ever hear one, mm-hmm. It's a very distinctive call. And that would be one sure way of knowing that's definitely a trumpeter, leave it alone. So it's controversial. And anytime you have these kind of conflicts where you can have something be confused for something else, you're going to have people opposing it. And I guess I'm not surprised to know some people really would oppose this one.
There's also some split opinion about a new hunting dog rule. Can you take us through that one?
Oh, yeah. I should have mentioned that. Right now, you know, it usually involves like the bear hounds, and also the same houndsmen use their hounds for hunting raccoons and bobcats. And, you know, by law, you know, if their dog can't be located or they know it's on someone's property, they have to get the landowner's permission to go in there and get their dog. And this law would basically make it where they can go in without permission and retrieve their dog, get it off their property, and bring it back in. And there's concern that this, you know, that this, you know, allows trespassing without permission, basically. And, you know, of course, the dog owners argue that a lot of times it's very hard to find landowners, and a lot of times it's hard to find landowners at night. If the dog's out there lost at night, well, what do you do? You start waking people up and, you know, to get your dog. So it's in some ways, it's not going to create conflict no matter what. So I guess I look at it and think, well, I can see where, yeah, we've opened things to possible abuse there by letting people trespass under the guise of retrieving a dog. But, you know, I don't think on those kind of things we'll ever have a perfect solution. So I think this one is worth talking about, at least, and getting some different opinions out there and seeing what people think about it.
And deer management, that's always a big issue here in the state. Any proposed changes that should come out of tonight?
Well, basically tonight, I don't think there's anything that pertains strictly to deer hunting on the questionnaire, but for the first time, and this is a new thing that the DNR is trying this year, is they're folding in their county updates on deer management. And, you know, this used to be a separate meeting they would hold about this time of year to bring people up to date on new rules for the fall. They'd go over the current estimates of deer numbers in the area. And because we're switching to a new deer management unit system, we're going away from the old, we used to have 136 separate deer management units. Well, now they've just done away with that idea, and just saying each county of the state is its own unique deer management unit.
So simplifying that a bit, so we may hear some about that tonight. And mm-hmm. for listeners who want to get involved, how do they find out where to go?
You can go on, you know, the DNR has a very easy process here. You go on their website, just go to the DNR website, and one of the tabs you'll see, it's pretty hard to miss it. There's one on the Conservation Congress, and you hit that tab, and it tells you the location of all 72 hearing sites.
Excellent. Well, Pat, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet.
We've been speaking with Wisconsin-based outdoor columnist Pat Durkin about Wisconsin's Conservation Congress.
We all know that we're supposed to eat plenty of fruits and vegetables as part of a healthy diet. The typical recommendation is 5 servings a day, and sometimes even that can be hard to squeeze in.
Now, new research suggests that 5 servings might not be enough, and there could be some significant health benefits to eating more like 7 or more portions of fruits and vegetables a day.
Here to talk about the latest research and to give us some tips on sneaking more good food into our diets is Laura Isaacson. She is a registered dietitian with Upland Hills Health in Dodgeville. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So let's talk a little bit about the new research first. What exactly did this study about the benefits of eating more fruits and vegetables, what did it find?
Well, this study was recently published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health, and we've known for a long time that fruits and vegetables are healthy. I think everyone knows that you should be eating fruits and vegetables, but this study actually showed that 7 or more portions of fruits and vegetables a day can lower your risk of dying by up to 42%. So that's pretty significant. And this is really the first study that showed that eating fruits and vegetables can lower kind of all causes of death, you know, cancer, heart disease. And it looked at a large number of people. It looked at over 65,000 people. So it's a pretty significant finding and just kind of adds to what we already know, that you should be eating lots of fruits and vegetables in your diet.
Yeah, and I was trying to discern from what the article I was reading, not just lowering cancer rates and heart disease, but other common diseases. Do you know what other common diseases were linked to eating fruits and vegetables?
Well, it showed the overall death. So they showed that people who ate fruits and vegetables lowered their risk of dying by any cause. If you eat 1 to 3 portions a day, it lowered your risk of dying by 14%. But as you eat more fruits and vegetables, your risk of dying continues to decrease. So if you eat up to 7 portions or more of fruits and vegetables per day, that lowers your risk of dying from any cause by 42%.
Wow. Well, let's put this in practical terms, because I always think of, a day's meals amount to about 3 meals a day, 2 snacks. So I picture myself planning to eat about 5 times a day.
Right.
But now you're saying we need to get 7 servings of fruits and vegetables alone in. I will always be eating. Tell me how to incorporate all this into my day.
So for some people, it is kind of hard to keep track of servings. A serving size of fruits and vegetables is a cup. Sometimes it's hard to remember how many servings I had at breakfast. And, you know, so the USDA actually has something called Choose My Plate. You may have seen it, but it's a way to make it a little bit easier for you. So when you're eating a meal, half of your plate should consist of fruits and vegetables. I know many people don't do that, but half of your plate should be fruits and vegetables. And then you should also include fruits and vegetables at all of your snacks.
You know, and that also takes time. We have to not only make the time to hit up the grocery store a couple times a week to make sure that we have fresh produce that hasn't rotted in our fridge. And then we have to wash it, prepare it. What tips do you have for making that a fairly simple and not very time consuming part of our life?
So if you don't have time to make it to the store, you can always buy frozen or canned fruits and vegetables. That's completely fine. It's, you know, the most important thing is just get them in your diet. If you do buy canned, just make sure that it's the no salt added or reduced sodium veggies. And then for fruits, make sure that it's in 100% fruit juice, not the heavy syrup, just to make it a little bit healthier. But also, you know, you can make sure that you're buying produce that's in season, that will be fresher, that will likely be less expensive than buying things that are out of season. Buying local, that generally will be a little bit fresher because it's, you know, not being transported from far away. Also, when you go to the grocery store and you buy all your fruits and vegetables, when you get home, you could wash them, cut them up, and have them already prepared in your refrigerator. So when you go to eat them, it's a little bit easier, and you've already done the preparation ahead of time.
Talk a little bit about how we can know what fruits are in season, and vegetables for that matter, at any given point in the year. Is there an easy way to tell?
Well, you know, there's lots of websites available that will tell you what fruits and vegetables are in season locally. One thing that you could do that would be kind of fun to do is join a community-supported agriculture, or a CSA. That way, you're getting fresh fruits and vegetables that are grown locally. There's not really much thought put into it. You join ahead of time, and then they will give you the produce that is in season and fresh. And so that's kind of a fun way to incorporate some new fruits and vegetables that maybe you haven't tried before. Many CSAs also give you recipes and give you tips on cooking. This may be a fun way for families to get kind of involved in preparing fruits and vegetables and kind of get excited about what's going to come in their CSA box each week.
Yeah, I've done that before, and it made me a more adventurous eater. I would get some vegetables that I had never heard of, and I didn't even know they just looked funny, you know?
Yeah.
But the farm was so kind to provide a newsletter each week that told us what it was and gave us a few ideas on how to make it. And it really worked out well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I read that getting more vegetables in your diet is actually more important than getting more fruit. Is that true, and why so?
Well, in this study, it did show that vegetables did have a larger effect on lowering incidence of death than fruit did. But fruit still does make a difference. So you need to have both in your diet. When you look at the colors of fruits and vegetables, I always try to get a wide variety of colors. Each color represents a different phytonutrient in your diet. And so veggies, you know, the dark green, those are really beneficial. They often have lutein in them, which can help prevent macular degeneration. When you think about tomatoes, that has the lycopene, which helps to prevent prostate cancer. So each fruit and vegetable that has a different color, that kind of represents a different health benefit. So I always tell people, when you're looking at your meals, you want it to look like a rainbow, or you want it to look like a box of crayons. That's kind of, you know, you don't want it all to be brown or all to be one color, because each different color provides a different nutrient that's beneficial for you. And if you're missing out on a color, you're missing out on a whole bunch of nutrients that are healthy for you.
Hmm. Any advice for getting these servings into the diets of our children? A lot of kids turn up their noses to some of these healthier foods, especially vegetables. What advice do you have for that?
Well, you know, kids can be kind of tricky getting them to eat things. Number one, set a good example. Eat these things yourself. You can't expect them to eat them if you're not doing it. Also, just make sure that they're always available and you keep offering them. Oftentimes, kids won't want to try something the first, second, or even 10th time you offer it. But if you keep offering it, eventually they will start to begin to accept it and to try it. It can take them up to 20 times sometimes to even accept a new food. So don't give up. Also, you can incorporate them into some recipes that you may be making. So include them in stir fries, in omelets, in soups, in casseroles. Just try to include them in some things that you're already making. Meatloaf, you know, you can add some veggies in there and kind of sneak in and they don't really know that they're eating it. So I would say just keep trying to add it to the foods that you're cooking, into your recipes. Look at your recipes. See, is there a way I could maybe cut up some tomatoes or cut up some peppers and sneak it in there? And just, you know, keep trying. And the most important thing is for you to be a good role model yourself and to be eating these things.
What about things like applesauce or other variations on fruits and vegetables that aren't necessarily purely the fruit itself, but derived from? Are those fine substitutes, especially as you're trying to get your kids to eat them?
Yes, I think any way you can get fruits and vegetables in their diet is great. The one thing I caution is juice. Juice, you know, I would avoid adding lots of juice to kids' diets. If they do drink juice, I would say maybe half a cup a day. My kids don't even drink juice at all. I don't even buy it because I think it's much better to eat the fruit. If you were to eat an apple or eat an orange, you're getting fiber in there. Juice is pretty much just the sugar. And so I try to avoid having lots of juice and promote eating the whole fruit instead. But if something like applesauce, that's fine. Or if there's another way that you need to puree up fruits and vegetables to get it into recipes or get it into their diets, that's completely fine.
Mm. Before our news break here, talk a little bit about what are there certain fruits and vegetables that are particularly good for you? Maybe something that you'd consider a superfood?
Well, I think anything with the dark colors. So the more deep, the more dark the color, really the better it is because it has more of those phytonutrients, which we know are cancer fighting. So spinach, that really dark green, that's better than eating some iceberg lettuce, for example. Berries, where you have blueberries, raspberries, those types of things with those really deep, dark colors have tons of those nutrients in them. So I, when I'm looking at fruits and vegetables, I try to pick the things with the deepest color.
We're talking with Laura Isaacson about the health benefits of eating fruits and vegetables, and we want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you make it a point to eat as many fruits and vegetables as you can? And do you have any creative ways to work them into your diet or your children's diet? Let us know, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with dietitian Laura Isaacson about the latest research regarding fruits and vegetables and how to incorporate them into your diet. So new research, new study, showing that instead of 5 servings of fruits and veggies a day, we need more like 7 servings, and that's a cup of fruits and vegetables to count for a serving, a lot more if you think about how much it takes to get this into your diet. How do you do it? Are you daunted by that recommendation? Have you found ways to get the fruits and vegetables into your diet? And what difference does it make in your life? And if you've got an easy recipe to share, so much the better. Our number, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also email us at talk@WPR.org.
Laura, you were saying that, all we have to do is just start small, get just a few servings in per day just to get started, maybe not trying to overhaul our entire diet to get 7 cups every single day. Give us a few tips. For example, salads might be a good way to get some of those servings in. How can we start spicing up our salads, making them more appealing to us?
Well, salads are a great way to get fruits and veggies in your diet. I love salads. It's fun to try maybe some different types of lettuce. Try some arugula in there rather than just, you know, a lot of people have iceberg lettuce, which is kind of boring. So maybe try some different types of lettuce, romaine lettuce, arugula, throw some spinach in there, spring greens. It's fun to add lots of different veggies in there. So add some tomatoes, carrots, beets. You can even spice it up with some black beans or garbanzo beans. That adds a little bit of extra fiber. I like to just season salads with a little bit of balsamic vinegar and olive oil, just to add a little bit of a different flavor. But just try to get with a salad, maybe just try some different things on there until it's not the same old boring salad that, you know, you have every day. A good snack, it would be something like some cut up carrots or peppers or broccoli, and you can dip them in hummus instead of, you know, ranch dressings, a little bit high in fat. So maybe try some hummus, and that's another way just kind of to get it in your diet for snacks. For my kids, even, you know, apples and peanut butter, that's a really easy snack that my kids love. And at least I'm getting them to have some fruits for a snack rather than something like crackers, which isn't quite so healthy for you. So that's a way that you can get it in for snacks. For your sandwiches or wraps, try to add lots of veggies in there. Spinach, tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers. Try to add all of those types of veggies onto your sandwiches. And even if you're making pasta or rice or a casserole, you can throw in some broccoli, tomatoes, squash, onions, peppers. Just throw it into stuff that you're already making. And so you don't have to really come up with new recipes, but look at the recipes that you already are making at home and see if there's a way you can just throw in some veggies. I, you know, oftentimes just kind of make up things. I look around the house, see what we have that is just kind of leftovers, and then cook up some spinach, tomatoes, throw it in with some rice or pasta, and it's oftentimes just things you have laying around.
Well, we have a couple of callers on the line at 800-642-1234. Let's talk to Dave in Elkhorn. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. What's your comment?
I developed a little system to get more vegetables into my diet. I call it soup is in the gravy. And what I do is I cook up vegetables ahead of time. I try to get a lot of, you know, the dark leafy vegetables and whatever I have around there, and I'll cook it up ahead of time in like a soup, and then let it cool, and then I put it in the blender and I blend it, and then I have that available, and then I can heat it up in small batches, and I pour it over like rice or millet or polenta. And, you know, it's like putting gravy over potatoes, but instead of potatoes, I use the grains, and I pour all these vegetables over the top and season it with a little, some nutritional yeast or tamari or something like that, you know, and it's real good.
Well, other than that, no spices or other seasonings?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's rye, that's salt, basically, and nutritional yeast, and, yeah, maybe a little pepper, you know. Whatever, you know, just flavor it to whatever you want to season it with. I don't put too many seasons on it. Yeah, but I get a lot of vegetables in my diet that way.
Great. Thanks, Dave. What do you think of that, Laura?
I think that's great, and I think what you're doing that's really excellent is you're preparing it ahead of time. So you're not making this really hard on yourself. You're actually making it pretty easy by blending everything up ahead of time. You have it prepared in the refrigerator, and then when it's time for you to eat something, it's very quick and very easy. And that's kind of the key, is making this easy. If it's really hard, no one's going to do it. So we've got to find a way to make it easy, and you've done just that.
Let's talk next to Ann in Waldo. Hi, Ann. What's your comment?
Hello?
Hi, Ann. What's your comment?
I just wanted to comment. First of all, enjoying your show. And I went vegan 8 weeks ago. I'm 58 years old. I'm back to working out. I'm running. I have more energy. I just can't believe it. I just kind of graze all day long. It's just fantastic. I recommend it to anybody.
Really? How hard was it for you to make that transition to being a vegan?
Well, I was a real meat eater. I loved my steaks. I loved all that. But when I go out with friends now and they eat that food, I just say, I remember what it tastes like. In fact, the other night I had a fish fry, a Perk's fish fry at one of my favorite places, and I really didn't enjoy it.
Mm.
So it's just been amazing. I just can't believe that changing over to just all plant-based foods can make you feel so good. Unbelievable.
Wow.
The way I feel is definitely worth giving up the meat products, for sure.
Well, thanks for that comment, Anne. Laura, I imagine, and I've talked to people about the transition to veganism, and I know some people who say, I would never be able to do that. I can't give up cheese.
Oh, yeah. I'm kind of in that camp right there because I do like cheese a lot. I think that's great. It sounds like she's being very healthy and most likely eating a lot of fruits and vegetables if she's following a vegan diet, and clearly she's feeling better. I think that's great. You know, for her, it's probably not for everybody, but I think the key is to just eat a healthy diet. And most likely she's feeling better because she's probably eating much healthier and eating more fruits and vegetables and probably getting 7 to 9 servings or more per day. So I think that's really the key, is when you do eat healthy, you feel better, you have more energy. And I think people feel real crummy when they eat kind of fatty foods and greasy foods and just lots of refined carbohydrates and just really unhealthy things make you feel not so great. So I'm all for that, for eating fruits and vegetables and eating healthy. People have energy and feel better.
What's the, if you can give a brief overview of this, what's the physiological explanation for that? What is it about fruits and vegetables that give us that energy that fuel our day?
Well, you know, they, as I said earlier, they have tons of nutrients in them. You're getting all of those phytonutrients that your body needs, antioxidants that your body needs, and then also they have lots of fiber in them, so it helps you to stay full. You'll notice if you eat a high fiber diet, lots of fruits and vegetables and whole grains, you feel full. You don't feel as hungry throughout the day. People are more hungry when they eat that kind of refined carbohydrates that don't stick with you. So when you eat fruits and vegetables, you just, you know, don't feel so sluggish. You feel more full, you feel better, have more energy because you're giving your body just good nutrition and all of the nutrients that you really need. I think people kind of feel crummy when they eat things that aren't very nutrient rich because your body's probably lacking some of the nutrition that it's needing to perform at its best.
You also suggested planting a garden. How will that impact our diet?
Oh, yeah. I mean, planting a garden is fantastic. It's a really fun thing to do with your kids. I'm planning on doing that this spring, planting some tomatoes and, you know, some easy things like that, a herb garden. You can plant eggplant, squash, things like that that aren't too difficult. And it's fun because you can just go out to the garden and pick your vegetable that you're going to have with your dinner that evening. So it's accessible. It's right there. It's fun to grow things. It's fun to see your garden come up. And it's very inexpensive, too. If people are looking for a way to get more vegetables in their diet, but they don't want to spend a lot of money, if you plant your own, it's really fun, and then you end up saving money as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's take one last call from Barry in Green Bay. Hi, Barry.
Hi there. How's everybody down there?
We're good.
Good, good. I just wanted to throw in my two cents about I went nuts one night watching late night TV infomercials and bought one of these, you know, gajillion horsepower blenders that I can take every vegetable in the world, throw it in there with some strawberries and maybe a little bit of fruit-based V8 and some kefir, and holy buckwheats, it tastes fabulous, and I build it up with a few things and you know get two drinks out of it, and I can cover probably 15, 18 servings of vegetables and fruits, you know, in these things, and I love it.
Well, Barry, you sold me at Holy Buckwheats.
Sorry.
That's okay. That's a great suggestion. Smoothies are fast and easy to make and something you can take on the go as well, right, Laura?
Yep, that's a great idea. I like making smoothies a lot in the summer for some reason. You know, in the summer, it's very refreshing to have a nice, cool drink like that. It's a way I can get my kids deep fruits and vegetables as well. It's kind of fun for them if we make a smoothie. That's another great suggestion, another way to hide some veggies in. If you make a smoothie with some fruit and berries, but maybe add a little bit of veggies in and they don't even really realize that they're eating vegetables. So I think that's a great idea. And again, it's really easy to do. You don't have to really know how to cook to make a smoothie. So it's something that I think everybody could do.
Mm-hmm. You shared a recipe with us for herbed spinach quiche portobello caps. We've got that linked to our Central Time Facebook page if anybody would like to take a look. But tell us a little bit about that, Laura.
Well, I actually got this recipe from the USDA. If you look on choosemyplate.gov, there are just a ton of resources, and that's information from the USDA. They have a ton of recipes. They actually have recipes from the White House. Michelle Obama has done a lot to promote fruits and vegetables. And so I got this off of there, and what I liked about it is it's a great way to include more fruits and vegetables. You have mushrooms, and you have some spinach, and it just looked really delicious. I haven't tried it yet, but I'm going to make it. I love portobello mushrooms. Spinach is probably one of my favorite vegetables. And so whenever I see a recipe with spinach in it, I get kind of excited and want to try it out. So I think, looking online, there's a lot of free recipes out there. You don't have to go buy cookbooks. You can find tons of stuff online. And the USDA, choosemyplate.gov is a great resource for people.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for sharing your suggestions and inspiring us to eat more healthfully.
Thank you.
Laura Isaacson is a registered dietitian with Upland Hills Health in Dodgeville.
Easter is celebrated this weekend, and eggs have a long history in Easter celebrations around the world. One Wisconsin woman keeps her Croatian heritage alive by creating and teaching others to make beautiful embroidered eggs.
My name is Stephanie Lemke Vuljanic. I grew up in a little town in Croatia, and I lived there till age 15. I came to the United States, got married, and had a son. 6 weeks after, I got very ill and couldn't move and was diagnosed with a severe arthritis and been fighting it ever since. My mom used to do the eggs for Easter for us children. That was a tradition, you know. We had a big celebration. We made fire in the morning on the top of the hill. It was gorgeous. Kids would be there singing and jumping. And when we got home, my mom would boil the eggs and she would get silk thread. And then she would wait for us when we got home. And we were so excited to tell her what happened there and everything. And then she would get the color of the threads out. And then she would say, okay, which color, you know. And doing that, she would talk to us. She would listen to what happened, and then little by little, she would inject like a moral teaching, you know. She would take a egg like this, and then she would say, look at this, you know. She would twist it around. She said, see, each time you look at it, no matter which way the eye is turning, you see a God eye. And that's how it is with God. Everything you are doing, God's eye is on you, and so you better behave. Then when I tell the story here, and people say, what did you do with those eggs? I said, we broke them. We play a game. And people go, oh, after all that work, you would break it? You know? But it was the process that was more important than product, you know? It was the memories that we created and everything. The eggs that I do somehow make me relax, make me feel good, you know. And I couldn't do it because I had surgery on both hands, you know. And I was thinking how difficult when you are a creative person and you want to do it and you don't do it. And then it dawned on me, I said, but I overcome a lot. I found out that this art died out. And my professor, who is, you know, looking after folk art in Croatia, he told me that it died out. And I said, no, it didn't. You know, I says, I'm doing this in America. And he says, no, no, you are too young to know that, you know. I says, no, I am not too young. My mom used to do it, my grandma, you know, and everybody. And so I know how to do it. And I sent some home so that they can do it. And I taught some people there, and I taught classes here. And so I think it's not going to die out.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. The series is a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
Here to talk about some of the Easter egg decorating traditions from Eastern Europe is Jim Leary. He's a professor of folklore and Scandinavian studies at UW-Madison and director of the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. I'm really glad to be here.
Sure. Well, to get us started, the unfortunate thing about radio is we can't see these beautiful Eastern European eggs. So could you describe them for us?
Well, there's quite a variety. The kind that Stephanie makes actually has this thread. It's not really appliqué, or, you know, it's tied around it in these intricate patterns that form eyes. Some people, like Stephanie Lemke, who's Slovak from the Milwaukee area, sometimes has done straw and kind of applique those. The most spectacular kind is perhaps, well, it is, the Ukrainian style that uses this batik or wax-resist technique to create many different colors and kind of intricate geometric patterns on the eggs. And Polish people make decorated eggs. I've run into Slovenians who've done it here in Wisconsin, so it's quite widespread.
Is it a tradition that's being passed along and is still fairly active here in Wisconsin?
Well, not as active as it once was, I think, with regard to some of these Eastern European traditions and perhaps some of the elaborate versions of them. I think Stephanie's pretty much the only one who does her style. But there's been kind of a revitalization of the Ukrainian style with people who aren't necessarily Ukrainian also taking it on. And last time I was doing much field work in the Portage County area, where there are lots of Polish people, there were folks who were doing this kind of drop pull or scratching technique with kind of little comet-like spirals on the eggs, and I would guess that's still going on too.
What does it take to sit down and make one of these in terms of not just an investment of time but skill? I imagine you have to have a very steady hand and, of course, a good eye.
Well, if you're doing the really fancy ones that Betty Christensen, for example, did, or what Stephanie is doing with the thread, yeah, you do have to concentrate, and they're totally different techniques. Stephanie has a little book, Stephanie Lemke. You can find it online, where she has watercolor paintings, and she's also on the Wisconsin Arts Board's Wisconsin Folks website, as is Betty Christensen. And with Betty, there are images there online on the Wisconsin Folk site of her very elaborate wax-resist Ukrainian-style eggs. And with those, yeah, there are very elaborate patterns, and then there are different colors, and you have to do multiple dyeing each time. You have to cover up you know, different layers that you don't want affected by the dye and subsequent kind of washes of it, and then you have to ultimately take all of the wax off, and then the egg color emerges. But even before that, a lot of times people will blow the eggs to get the yolk off, or although not everyone does that. So a lot of work invested for sure.
Now, are these eggs mostly bound up with religious celebrations of Easter, or do they have any other cultural significance?
Well, they go back, of course, to pre-Christian days in Eastern Europe, and they're tied up with fertility and the coming of spring, and they've often been used for 1,000 years or so as these sort of gifts of good fortune. So, you know, they do obviously have this Christian overlay where in some ways the egg bursting from the chicken bursting from the shell would be akin to, you know, Christ coming out of the tomb at Easter. But, people have used them, for other reasons, for reasons that are tied up with family and friendship and good luck for the year and the coming of the new season.
One thing we heard in that story, she mentioned that at the end they break the egg, and she mentioned that people have expressed their surprise. Why would you put all this time and investment into this creation and then break it? But it made me think about the contrast of cultures, I guess, that we in our modern U.S. society are more possession-centric, but here she's talking about the process precedes the product. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's really a profound statement, and I think a lot of artists do feel that way. In 1986, when I first met Stephanie, Janet Gilmore and I were doing this folk art survey for the Kohler Arts Center, and there was a pinata maker, Patricia Yamas, who felt that pinatas should not last. They needed to be destroyed. And later I met the late Ken Funmaker Sr., a great Ho-Chunk artist, and he used to say that the stuff that he made, he said, it doesn't mean a damn thing, he said. You know, it's not the thing, it's not the object, it's really the doing of it and the meaning of it that is significant.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for coming on and talking about these eggs with us today.
It was a treat. Yeah, it's gone fast.
Well, it always does. Thank you so much. And it's lovely to think about these eggs as we go into the Easter holiday. We're speaking with Jim Leary there, professor of folklore and Scandinavian studies at UW-Madison and the director of the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. He was with us, of course, to talk about Eastern European egg decorating traditions.